org. Right now it's time for All Things Considered.
I'm looking for a job, and I've always wanted to work at McDonald's, but I never did.
With just a couple weeks to go, both presidential candidates are ramping up their travel.
What the campaign trail looks like this Monday, October 21st on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. An American activist talks about what it's like to be an alleged target of the Indian government.
I'm going to continue campaign, and I'm going to continue to protect myself.
Also, thousands of migrant workers are now stranded in Lebanon as fighting has escalated.
We have seen fire, bombing sounds, and a lot of things that has happened, which is the first time in my life to experience something like this.
And University of Chicago students are sprucing up their dorm rooms with works of art from the school's museum.
Those stories and more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The presidential candidates are ramping up their campaigns in the final stretch. Former President Donald Trump is in the swing state of North Carolina today. At a rally in Greenville, he reiterated his pledges to bring down inflation and curb immigration.
I'm here today with a message of hope for all Americans. With your vote in this election, I will end inflation, I will stop the invasion, and I will bring back the American dream.
Vice President Kamala Harris kicked off a swing state tour in Pennsylvania today. In suburban Philadelphia, Harris once again warned that Donald Trump is unfit to hold office again.
I have said many times publicly, and I'll say it again, in many, many ways, Donald Trump is an unserious man. But the consequences of him being president of the United States are brutally serious.
With the race and apparent dead heat, both candidates are looking for every possible vote, especially from those who remain undecided. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is on his way to Israel. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Blinken will once again push for a ceasefire deal in Gaza and try to calm tensions in Lebanon.
Less than a week after Israeli forces killed the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza, Secretary Blinken boarded his plane to Israel to see if he can build on this possible turning point in the war. State Department spokesman Vedant Patel says Blinken will talk about ways to bring the war in Gaza to an end.
He will continue discussions with counterparts on post-conflict period planning and emphasize the need to chart a new path forward that enables Palestinians to rebuild their lives and realize their aspirations free from Hamas's tyranny.
He says the secretary will also press Israel to allow aid into Gaza, where Israel has intensified its attacks. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The White House is pushing insurance companies to cover the cost of over-the-counter contraception. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports.
Under the Affordable Care Act, women have been able to get birth control pills for $0 at the pharmacy counter if they use their health insurance. But that means they needed to have a prescription. Now that the Food and Drug Administration has approved an over-the-counter birth control pill, which does not require a prescription from a doctor, the Biden administration wants health insurance to cover that too. The Biden administration proposed a new rule requiring health insurance to cover the OTC birth control pill, which is called O-pill, as well as spermicide, Plan B, and condoms. The rule, if it goes through, would likely not take effect until at least 2025. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 344 points. This is NPR. By a razor-thin margin, citizens in Moldova have voted to change the constitution to enshrine future membership in the European Union. Terry Schultz reports both Moldovan and EU authorities say Russia launched a massive effort to make a no vote win.
It was only in the final hours of ballot counting that the number of votes in favor of Moldova joining the European Union overtook the number rejecting the move. The balance was reportedly tipped by the pro-EU attitudes of Moldovans voting from abroad. Pro-EU President Maia Sandu, who was simultaneously up for re-election, had warned that what she called criminal groups were, for example, paying voters to oppose EU membership, busing them to polling stations, and pumping out pro-Kremlin propaganda. European Commission spokesman Peter Stano echoed that view from Brussels.
This vote took place under unprecedented interference and intimidation by Russia and its proxies, aiming to destabilize the democratic processes.
The EU opened membership negotiations with Moldova in December. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Hurricane Oscar has slammed into Cuba. The storm made landfall on day three of a nationwide power outage. The island's main energy plant failed on Friday, cutting off electricity to millions of people. Service was partially restored on Saturday before it collapsed for a second time. The government has ordered non-essential workers to stay home to safeguard the electricity supply, and non-vital government services have been suspended. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pokegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Loving the lake quietly. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, slight chance for showers in the northwest Minnesota, lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow, chance of showers and thunderstorms.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We are just 2 weeks out from Election Day. Over the weekend, Vice President Harris was in Georgia speaking to potential voters at black churches.
Our strength is not based on who we beat down, as some would try and suggest. Our strength is based on who we lift up. And that spirit is very much at stake in these next 16 days.
Donald Trump, on the other hand, was at a McDonald's in Pennsylvania, doling out French fries for the cameras.
I'm looking for a job, and I've always wanted to work at McDonald's, but I never did.
Trump also went to an NFL game in Pittsburgh and took questions from supporters in the state. And this campaign travel will only ramp up this week. Let's talk about the week ahead with NPR's senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so Vice President Harris is out today with Liz Cheney, who, of course, is a conservative former congresswoman from Wyoming. They're traveling in key swing states. What is the strategy there?
Well, Harris's team really believes that winning over even a marginal percentage of Republican-leaning voters in key suburban counties can really make the difference. You know, she's going to be in Oakland County, Michigan, Waukesha, Wisconsin, and Chester County, Pennsylvania. Those are all very populous suburbs, and this might have to do less with winning over actual Republicans in big numbers than maybe disaffected independents who might lean Republican and, you know, just hitting those margins from 2020 that Biden had gotten. Remember, Biden won 51% of the vote in 2020, and part of that is because of the shift in some of these populous suburbs. In all three of these counties, Biden either won by bigger margins than Hillary Clinton, like in Oakland and Chester counties, or cut into Trump's margins, like in Waukesha.
Okay, that's the Harris side of things. Meanwhile, Trump is in North Carolina today. He's surveying damage from Hurricane Helene, right? How might we think about the political impact of a disastrous storm like Helene?
Well, Trump won a majority of the votes from the counties in western North Carolina that FEMA designated as eligible for some form of disaster relief. So getting the infrastructure there back up and running and making sure people have access to voting is critical for Trump's campaign. Trump, though, hasn't helped things because he started and spread a lot of misinformation about Biden's administration's, you know, disaster relief efforts. Democrats certainly are affected, too, because Asheville was hit pretty hard. About 100,000 Democratic votes come out of Buncombe County. But everywhere around it is pretty heavily Republican.
Oh, interesting. Okay, where else will the candidates be this week?
I mean, it's a really frenetic schedule this week. And for them and their surrogates, you know, Harris, like we noted, is going to be in the blue wall states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania just today. She's then doing a TV interview with NBC tomorrow, and then on Wednesday participates in a CNN town hall in Pennsylvania. She'll be in Georgia later in the week for a rally with former President Obama, who has been on the trail for her, like in Nevada, over the weekend. Harris will then be in Michigan on Saturday with another big Obama name, Michelle, the former first lady. Trump is in North Carolina today and tomorrow, then Georgia and Nevada. On Sunday, he's doing a rally at Madison Square Garden in New York. That's politically curious because he doesn't really have a chance to win New York, but it's the ultimate showman move. Perform at the most famous arena in the country.
Sure, MSG. Okay, that is a lot of travel. I mean, what does that tell you about both of their strategies at this point with so little time left?
Yeah, their travel really tells you. For Harris, for example, she's got a big focus on the blue wall. Holding those three would mean an almost certain Harris win. But Trump, on the other hand, is trying to, in particular, chip off Pennsylvania, insulate himself in the Sun Belt states. He can't afford to lose any of those because doing so would open up more paths to 270 for Harris.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thank you, Domenico.
You're welcome.
Foreign governments are increasingly trying to silence critics overseas. That includes here in the U.S., where the Justice Department says it has foiled at least four assassination plots in recent years tied to a foreign power. One case involves India. And last week, Indian officials were here in Washington for talks about the alleged plot to target an American activist in New York. NPR's Ryan Lucas recently visited the activist to hear about how having a target on his back has changed his life.
It is a phone call that Gurpatwat Singh Panoon remembers well. It was June 17th, 2023, and after playing phone tag for a day, he and his close aide in Canada finally managed to connect.
He told me that he was informed by the Canadian intelligence officials that there is a serious threat to his life and he might be killed.
On that call, his aide, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, said that assassins were coming for Panoon as well. This conversation is seared into Panoon's memory because of what Nijjar told him, but also because of what happened the following day.
Police say the killing of a man outside a Sikh temple Sunday night appears to have been targeted. They say the victim was the temple's president, Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
On June 18, 2023, gunmen shot Nijjar dead in the parking lot of a Sikh temple outside Vancouver. Canadian authorities have arrested four Indian nationals in connection with the murder. Last week, Canada said India's top diplomat in the country and five other diplomats were persons of interest in the case and expelled them. As it turns out, Panoon's life also was in danger. 5 months after Nijjar's killing, the U.S. Justice Department announced it had foiled a plot to assassinate Panoon in New York City. An Indian national was charged in the alleged murder-for-hire scheme. He has pleaded not guilty. And then last week, prosecutors announced charges against a new defendant, a former Indian intelligence official who allegedly orchestrated the plot. Panoon tells NPR the threat to his life came as no surprise.
I have been threatened directly by the Indian parliamentarians. While sitting in the Indian parliament, they have stated that we are going to kill Panoon even if we have to do a surgical strike. These are all well-documented statements of the government officials.
In particular, he points to a statement Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has made several times in recent years, including early this July to lawmakers in India's parliament.
Today, post-2014, India enters your home and kills you, carries out surgical strikes, carries out airstrikes.
In Panoon's view, Modi's threat about how India deals with its perceived enemies is directed at people like him. Panoon is discussing all of this at his law office in Queens. Boxes of case files and legal books line the walls. Panoon is a practicing attorney. That work pays the bills. But much of his time he dedicates to the cause of the Khalistan movement, which wants to create an independent Sikh homeland carved out from northern India. He and his organization, Sikhs for Justice, have been leading a global referendum for independence. This office is the center of his campaign work. Against one wall, he has a green screen set up and cameras.
That's where we make our messages, like even for the campaign.
Behind his desk hangs a yellow and blue Khalistan flag.
Huh. Yeah, that's where we run our operations right now.
On the wall is a framed picture of the Golden Temple in Amritsar, India, the holiest site in Sikhism. Panoon and Nijjar first worked together to document the events surrounding the Indian military's attack on the temple in 1984, known as Operation Blue Star, and the government's bloody, nearly decade-long effort to stamp out Sikh separatism. Thousands were killed. The two men then shifted their focus to the future and started the Khalistan referendum campaign. The idea is to have Sikhs around the world vote on the question of creating an independent Sikh state. Panoon has dedicated his life to the campaign. He told his family years ago that his advocacy work would put him at odds with India's government.
That's why when we are talking about assassination attempts and killings and threats, that doesn't come as a surprise to us. That doesn't come as a surprise to the family.
The Modi government has designated Panoon a terrorist for his separatist work, Nijjar too. Panoon rejects the allegation. He says he follows the law and that his campaign is a peaceful, democratic process. India's response, though, he says, has been to come after him, even trying to kill him. And that has forced Panoon to look over his shoulder.
100%. That's how I'm going to survive, to go to the finish line.
The foiled assassination plot was not a one-off, he says. There are active threats right now against his life. That danger has not forced him to end his advocacy work, but it has forced him to take precautions. At his office, a security team screens visitors with a metal detector. Bodyguards ferry him to and from work. He says he had security before the alleged plot, but it's been beefed up since then.
Today what you see is very, very obvious. And this is a message I'm giving that I'm not out there to do it in a suicide mode. I'm going to continue campaign and I'm going to continue to protect myself.
Still, the threat on his life has altered to a degree how he operates. Our meeting is in his office in part because it is secure. I ask whether we could have met in a cafe instead.
Yeah, if we would have known it in advance, maybe we could have gone. I cannot just abruptly take a car and jump in the car and go anywhere. That's what I have been advised by my security details. That's where you get killed.
He's changed his residence several times since the alleged plot was foiled. He doesn't go to restaurants much. He says he hasn't been to the grocery store in years. He gets things delivered. And he's curtailed his on-the-ground campaign appearances. But he's still very active online. He posts videos to Instagram on a regular basis. Some of them show pro-Khalistan rallies. Others are heated challenges against India or Indian officials.
Sikhs are facing existential threat under the successive Indian regimes.
In this one from last November, he's calling for a boycott of India's national airline.
And we are going to target India. From Air India to Made in India, we are going to ground everything.
Some of the posts are about his late colleague and friend, Hardeep Singh Nijjar. His assassination, Panoon says, has left a hole.
You feel the vacuum, but then you also get the strength and the courage what Nijjar stood for what he gave his life for what he has spent last 15, 16 years with us.
But Panoon also says there is no time to sit back and grieve. There's work to be done, a campaign to run, despite the risks. And he would rather take a bullet in his head, he says, than stop his work for the movement. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering rotating taproom exclusive beers and crowlers to go. The latest offerings available Tuesday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., and Sunday, 11 to 8. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Now for your daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, October 21st, in the year 2001, the leaves have finally dropped enough among the willows so that the autumn willows are exposed. These autumn willows have great fuzzy catkins that are quite evident once all the leaves are down around them. The plant actually blooms in summer, and the seeds are simply stored in a pod and held until fall, when the pods begin to burst open and the little tufts of cottony seed begin to come out. What makes the autumn willow special and more interesting than some others, aside from the fact that it's easy to recognize because of these pods, is that it is not rhizotomous, and it doesn't form great clumps of autumn willows. So with the autumn willow, what you'll see is a plant here, and then a plant over there, and then another plant over there somewhere else. Never a cluster of autumn willows in one spot. You won't see dozens of these plants in one spot. They tend to separate out. And so the seed production is important because it's obvious that each one must grow from a seed.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters on Friday, November 1st. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has made demonizing immigrants a central part of his presidential campaign. One of his favorite targets, migrants from Venezuela.
Look at what's happening with some of these towns. They're being talked about all over the world, but in a very horrible way, occupied by members of savage prison gangs from Venezuela.
It's a false narrative, but it's one that's taking root even in parts of the Venezuelan community, as NPR's Adrian Florido reports from Miami.
When Hugo Chavez came to power in Venezuela in the late 90s, Gustavo Garagorri despaired over his country's socialist turn. He was part of the first wave of Venezuelans to leave. He fled to Miami.
So I have here more than 22 years. I'm working very hard, and I'm very happy to be here.
He's now a U.S. citizen, a business consultant, also president of the Venezuelan American Republican Club of Miami-Dade. And in the last few years, he says he's watched in horror as a new wave of migrants from his country have arrived at the southern border seeking asylum and been let into the U.S.
No quiero generalizar, pero
I don't want to generalize, he says, but
a lot of the people that's come from Venezuela is criminals that's coming to this country.
This idea that most of the Venezuelans coming to the U.S. are thugs and delinquents has taken firm root in conservative media and among Republican politicians. Donald Trump repeats it constantly, like during his recent visit to Aurora, Colorado.
In Venezuela, their crime rate went down 72%. You know why? Because they took the criminals out of Caracas and they put them along your border and they said, if you ever come back, we're going to kill you.
There's no evidence that claim is true. Police in some cities are concerned about a Venezuelan prison gang called Tren de Aragua, but local mayors say Trump has grossly exaggerated its reach, and data makes clear that migrants commit fewer crimes, far fewer, than native-born Americans. Still, Garagorri takes Trump's side on this, and he worries about the public perception.
¿Qué queda en la mente de la persona? Que los venezolanos.
What stays in people's minds, he asks? That Venezuelans are doing harm. That's why he likes to hear Donald Trump promise he's going to carry out mass deportations.
¿Qué es lo que queremos? Sí, que los deporten, que se los saquen, que se los lleven de aquí.
Our community doesn't want these people, he says. Deport them. His sentiments get to the heart of a growing rift in the Venezuelan community between older and newer immigrants. They also help explain why some recent polls show more Latinos expressing support for deportation and why Democrats have slipped with Latinos while Republicans have gained in some places.
Listen, I think there's a very real desire to protect our position here in the United States as a new community.
Valentina Pereda is Venezuelan-American. She co-founded a group called the Venezuelan Diaspora Project to counter the image of Venezuelan migrants as criminals.
If the data is telling us that less than 1% of these migrants are actually committing violent crimes, then I think it would be best to start looking at the data and not just what sensationalist narratives are trying to condition us with.
Pereda first started realizing how effectively those narratives about Venezuelans were spreading among other Venezuelans when she heard her mother repeating them.
And I was very confused. I said, excuse me, you were an undocumented immigrant yourself for 21 years until I was able to give you papers. What is this feeling? And, you know, and she started saying things like, yeah, but, you know, these people are different.
Bereda pointed out to her mom that most of the Venezuelans coming now are poorer than those who came when she did 2 or 3 decades ago, and that many are darker skinned, but that they're coming for the same reasons. Her mother, Gisela Bereda, says what really changed her mind was hiring some newer Venezuelan migrants at her catering business and hearing firsthand about their arduous journey on foot across 7 countries.
Even we Venezuelan people living in this country have no clue about all that nightmare. You really have to be brave.
Her daughter, Valentina, through her diaspora project, helps Venezuelan migrants to showcase their artistic and cultural talents. And she warns fellow Venezuelans about the dangers of demonizing their countrymen.
Because what are you going to do when the narrative balloons to a place where there's so much distrust for the Venezuelan community that people even start distrusting you?
Instead, they should fight back, she tells them, so those narratives can't take hold. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Miami.
World leaders are gathering in Colombia for the next 2 weeks to try and slow what the United Nations has called humanity's senseless and suicidal war with nature. NPR's Nathan Rott will be following. He joins us now. Hey, Nate.
Hey.
So, Nate, tell us, what's this meeting all about?
Yeah, so this is a conference of nearly every nation on the planet, every country that signed on to protect the world's plants, animals, and ecosystems under something called the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity. It's, you know, very similar to the UN meetings on climate change.
Sounds like a small little intimate gathering, right?
Yeah, just your average group of ministers, ecologists, industries, research institutes trying to figure out how to deal with what's really an existential problem for the whole of humanity.
I mean, that feels like kind of an impossible task. Help me understand this. How is the loss of nature an existential problem for humanity?
Well, look, I mean, we all breathe, eat, and drink water, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that might be a good place to start.
Sure.
You know, living creatures, including humans, you know, depend on everything from the smallest phytoplankton in the ocean that clean our air to insects that pollinate our food to forests that help regulate the world's climate. But a recent report shows that wildlife populations on average globally have declined by 73% over the last 50 years. One of that report's authors, Rebecca Shaw, chief scientist at the World Wildlife Fund, says that it's a warning sign that many natural systems are in grave danger.
If we look at the Amazon rainforest in particular, there's a real chance that the Amazon rainforest could tip to be a savanna or a savanna grassland. If that happens, we will see a release of billions of tons of carbon. We will see the devastation of biodiversity. But even more worrying, we will see changes in global climate that will have implications for the stability and consistency of our food production.
Okay, clearly there's a lot at stake here, but how is this conference supposed to help?
Yeah, so this year's meeting is essentially like a check-in, right? 2 years ago in Montreal, world leaders signed on to this huge global framework that's really supposed to help humanity achieve harmony with nature. That is literally how they frame it. There was a pledge in there to protect 30% of the world's land and water by 2030, a pledge to reduce subsidies to industries that are harming nature, like fossil fuel companies, pledges to reduce food waste, to provide money for poorer countries in the global south, 23 different pledges in total.
So tell us, Nate, how close are they to this goal of helping humanity achieve harmony with nature?
They have a very long ways to go. There's been a bunch of reports and studies over the last few weeks showing that countries are off track to meet many of the goals that they set out to accomplish, in some cases by a lot. I talked to the executive secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity, Astrid Schumacher, and she said she does see some hope. Let's listen to her now.
The fact that this is a bit slow is not because there's no action being taken, but it is because countries are taking these processes more seriously. They're more broad-based. It's not just an environment ministry that drafts the plan. They're really involving other ministries.
So in other words, countries need to go beyond just creating a new national park or protected area and really rethink their governments and entire economies. And she thinks that that is now starting to happen.
NPR's Nathan Rott, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
This is NPR News.
A church pastor and activist in Allentown, Pennsylvania, tries to encourage people in his community to vote despite their cynicism about government.
They don't understand what's at risk.
All they understand is that when they go to the grocery store, they keep getting less in the bag than more.
Just one of the many voices brought to us by our team in the swing state of Pennsylvania. Hear more tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji, located at 505 Bemidji Avenue. Galleries are open to the public. Their on-site retail store features regionally created art, home decor, and handcrafted gifts. More information at watermarkartcenter.org. During the Come Home to KAXE Fall Membership Drive, our staff are hosting Trivia Night Thursday, October 24th in both Bemidji and Grand Rapids. Both events start at 6 p.m. at Bemidji Brewing and Clockout Brewing in Grand Rapids. All are welcome. And we receive support from the Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northeastern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles, with staff available to assist. On the Beltline in Hibbing or at HibbingChrysler.us.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Washington State Office that helps secure grant funding for outdoor projects has hired someone to coordinate with Native American tribes. Steve Jackson has more.
Spokane tribal citizen Don Pullen is the Washington State Recreation and Conservation Office's first tribal affairs director. Pullen has a varied resume working with the Spokane tribe and recently served as well as a tribal liaison for the Washington State Patrol. In her new role, Pullen says she'll have a chance to work closely with Washington tribes to find funding for various projects.
I'm going to take my lead from the tribe. Like, what does the tribe need from me? And how can we communicate and collaborate in consultation and work together and ensure that, you know, tribal sovereignty is upheld?
She says tribal priorities include salmon recovery projects, which are a big part of the state agency's mission. Additionally, she says tribes could benefit from funding for recreation projects such as trails and parks. Pullen is studying a list of past grants the Recreation and Conservation Office secured for tribes to determine what future projects could benefit from funding. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
Last week, a signing ceremony took place in Anchorage, Alaska, between tribes and federal agencies to work together to address the collapse of salmon. And as KNBA's Jill Freitas reports, the history-making agreement was a trailblazing event.
It was held in downtown Anchorage during the Alaska Tribal Unity Gathering. More than 2 years ago, Department of the Interior leaders heard from Alaska Native tribes about the salmon collapses, their impacts on communities and cultures, and the need for immediate and lasting action by the federal government. More than 100 tribes, as well as federal agencies, discussed co-stewardships, where both traditional knowledge and Western science were brought to the table to come up with a solution for the devastating impacts to the salmon population. During the hour-long discussion, multiple people spoke of the long road hundreds of tribes and communities face. Vivian Corthias is from Mnemonic and is the chief executive officer of the Association of Village Council Presidents. She is on the Gravel to Gravel board and says that with the combined forces of the tribes in Alaska, as well as federal agencies, they are sure to make a big impact.
If we had an initiative where there was only one leader, either the feds or in our case, just the tribes do it alone, it wouldn't work. We know that. Those of us that are sitting up here are working on behalf of every single community, every single tribe, every single family.
Corthias says that in recent years, the consistent decline in salmon becomes more devastating each year.
What I believe is that this is really a true humanitarian crisis. It's unthinkable that we have the third largest river, the Yukon River, in this nation, and we have no salmon to put away. It's mind-boggling.
Brian Ridley is chief of the Tanana Chiefs Conference.
It's really a lot about salmon habitat restoration, and so trying to make sure that the salmon have good areas to spawn in across Alaska and that we have a healthy environment for the salmon to be able to come back to, in an effort to try to get them to come back to how they once were 20, 30, 40 years ago.
The board will meet regularly throughout the next few years to discuss more solutions for the salmon crisis. In Anchorage, I'm Jill Freitas.
And October 21st marks the 12th annual Native American College Fair. Hosted at the Minnesota History Center, more than 40 colleges from across the U.S. will be on site to discuss higher ed opportunities with Native students and their families. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Native votes are Native voices. Help create a brighter Indigenous future by voting this November 5th. Learn more about the power of your vote at aknativevote.org. This message was brought to you by Carnegie.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Ethiopians and Kenyans are among those who have been evacuated from Lebanon amid an escalation of Israeli airstrikes and clashes with the militant group Hezbollah. Thousands more Africans are still stranded in Lebanon, alongside other migrant workers from different nations. Some have been abandoned by their employers and have no means to go home. Emmanuel Agunza reports from Nairobi.
At Ethiopia's main airport in Addis Ababa, it's joy and celebration as a charter plane carrying Ethiopians evacuated from Lebanon arrives. On board, the first group of 51 young women happily hug, kiss and thank government officials who are here waiting to receive them home.
I never thought I would ever return home.
Among them is 22-year-old Zinash Kitele, who is overjoyed to be back after weeks of uncertainty.
It was scary. It was difficult getting to the airport there in Lebanon and then coming home to Addis Ababa. But it's all God's grace.
This video of a distressed Kenyan woman and her friends has been trending for days in Kenya. In it, she can be heard crying to her sister. Houses nearby are flattened, she cries. I can see fire everywhere around me, she says, amid the sounds of heavy explosions.
Everything is traumatizing currently. It's shocking. Everyone is worried.
35-year-old Yulita Jerop from Kenya is among nearly 200,000 migrant workers in Lebanon. The majority of them are from Ethiopia, Kenya, the Philippines, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka, and most of them women.
We are living in fear. We have nothing to do. We just sit down and watch the news. We have seen fire, bombing sounds, and a lot of things that has happened, which is the first time in my life to experience something like this.
Many work under the controversial kafala system, sponsored by employers to work in the host country, which often means they're at their mercy, low wages, missing legal documents, including passports. As the fighting intensifies in southern Lebanon and Beirut, thousands of migrant workers have been abandoned by their employers who have fled for safety themselves. The international airport in Beirut remains open for now, but air tickets cost thousands of dollars. And so, many stranded workers and their families either end up abandoned or on the streets. If they're lucky, they get access to a shelter like this one in Beirut. If, as many migrant workers have claimed, they are not turned away fast. For now, many like Jerop are stranded in a war zone.
We just pray and hope things will go well, so that we go back to our country safely. Our cry is to go back home safely.
Her employers want her to stay. Her government is ineffectual. And every day of escalating fighting is a reminder of the need to get out of Lebanon by any means possible. For NPR News, I'm Emmanuel Igunza in Nairobi, Kenya.
And today in Texas, state lawmakers wanted to hear from death row inmate Robert Roberson, whose life was spared last week just 90 minutes before his execution. Lawmakers held a hearing today about a Texas law that prohibits the use of so-called junk science in court cases. But Roberson was not part of the hearing. Blaise Ganey with the Texas Newsroom has been covering all of this and joins us now from Austin. Hi, Blaise.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, thanks okay. Well, thanks for being with us. Wait, so lawmakers said they wanted Roberson to testify at this hearing, so why didn't he?
Well, while the request was made for Roberson to speak to lawmakers in person, Attorney General Ken Paxton's office said that Roberson was not transported to the Texas State Capitol. His attorney said that in person was preferred because their client suffers from autism, although they were trying to make sure that the Attorney General wanted it to be virtual. Now, the chair of the committees, Representative Joe Moody, said they are in talks with the AG's office to find a way to make sure they can hear from Roberson on this matter. And here's what he said today.
There's been a lot of discussion about video conferencing Robert in today. I believe that that'd be perfectly reasonable for most inmate witnesses. But Robert is a person with autism who has significant communication challenges, which was a core issue that impacted him at every stage of our justice system.
So they still haven't heard from him today, and it's not sure if they'll be able to schedule a later date.
Well, this hearing, I mean, is focused on a Texas law that prohibits the use of junk science. And I understand there's a question on whether junk science was used in this case, right? Did lawmakers make any headway on that?
Yeah, so quickly for background, you know, Roberson was convicted in the 2002 death of his daughter. It was thought she died from being violently shaken. However, it was later discovered that she likely died from pneumonia. So lawmakers are trying to see if the law that says when new scientific evidence comes out, it needs to be taken into account, was applied correctly in Roberson's case, and if not, why not? So what they can make sure in the future, that it'll work in other cases, but I'm not sure if they'll be able to make it apply to Roberson's case.
Well, who else are lawmakers hearing from? And I guess the real question is, will their findings even affect this case at all?
Yeah, I think it'll have a slim chance of affecting his case. The governor and AG seem set on making sure that the execution happens. In fact, Governor Greg Abbott's general counsel filed an amicus brief last night, citing that only the governor can legally delay an execution in Texas. Now, one of the witnesses today was Dr. Phil, the TV personality. Mm-hmm. He is involved with the Innocence Project and said he has met Roberson. He said the science used to convict him was wrong, and when he was asked whether he thinks a new trial would not result in a capital murder conviction, here's what he said.
I think this is a case where there was no crime committed. I don't think we have the wrong person. I don't think a crime was committed.
This is so interesting. Okay, so what is next in this case?
Yeah, as for the junk science law, lawmakers will likely look into this during the upcoming session in January. But as for Mr. Roberson, it's unclear if this at all will be able to help him avoid being put to death, even with there being new evidence that he may not be guilty.
That is Blaise Ganey with the Texas Newsroom, a collaboration between Texas public radio stations and NPR. Thank you so much, Blaise.
Thank you.
There's this photo from the finish line of the Detroit Free Press Marathon on Sunday. A woman has jumped into a man's arms and they kiss. They can't believe it. They both just won.
I just knew, like, the minute I turned that corner, I was running into his arms. The last couple miles are pretty painful. And I would, like, just get to that finish line because he's going to be there waiting on the other side.
Sydney DeVore Bowman and Andy Bowman met at a nearby race. She encouraged him to train for the Detroit Half Marathon in a few months, where they reconnected.
I was like, you did it. Like, you showed up. And he's like, you told me to. I'm like, oh. So then I asked him out on a date pretty much right after that.
Pretty cute. Fast forward 2 years after their wedding, Andy wins the full men's marathon and waits for the first woman to finish.
Just anticipation, almost like watching her walk down the aisle. But being at the finish line and seeing her turn the corner and she had this big smile on her face as she's running towards me, it's enough to get you pretty emotional.
Next up for Sydney and Andy is the Pittsburgh 10-miler in under just 3 weeks, where they will both be hoping for something of a rerun. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Need a drink to forget this stressful election season? Well, in one Paris bar, predicting the outcome of the U.S. presidential election over cocktails is a long tradition. For more than a century, a straw poll taken there has been pretty accurate at predicting the winner. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley tells us more.
Harry's Bar has been a watering hole for American expats in Paris since 1911. College pennants line the walls of this cozy establishment, which claims to have invented the Bloody Mary. In 1924, the Harry's Bar straw poll was born. Franz Arthur McAlone is the bar's fourth generation owner.
So 100 years ago, Americans couldn't vote in Europe. And he had loads of American in the neighborhood. And my great-granddad thought, we're going to do a straw vote, a fake vote, and make a party out of it.
Americans abroad can vote today, but Harry's straw poll has endured. It's only been wrong three times in the last century. This year, the original wooden ballot box is set up at the end of the bar. Like Ernest Hemingway once did, expat writer Douglas Kennedy pushes his ballot through the slot.
I'm very honored as an American writer who the French seem to like, you know, to be voting here today. I remember coming here in 1974 when I was a 19-year-old kid and could just about afford a beer, not a cocktail.
Bob Valier with Democrats Abroad says there are 6 million Americans living overseas, but only 1 in 6 votes. The reason? The U.S. is one of the few nations that requires its citizens abroad to also pay income tax back home.
So people want to avoid getting caught in that net, and they think that voting might be some sort of trap. It's absolutely not. Your ability to vote has nothing to do with your tax status.
Many expats don't bother voting because they think they've left America and its problems behind. But the choice of U.S. president impacts the world, says Renita Radonikita. This Lithuanian says it'll be a disaster if Donald Trump wins. He'd let Russia take Ukraine, and her Baltic country might be next.
In Lithuania, since everything that's been going on, like all my family that's there, they all have like a bag packed and all these, like, it's scary.
Oh my God. Can I take a picture of
you?
This?
Do you understand?
No, I understand.
But it doesn't stop her enjoying a conversation and cocktail with Frances Jones from New Jersey, who she suspects has cast her Harry's ballot for Trump.
There's two sides, obviously, to everything. And I feel like you can vote with your heart and your feelings, or you can vote with your head and your pocket. I'm stressed because I think it's going to go down to the wire.
So you have your Harris and Trump piles?
Yeah, and I'm going to count the whole thing afterwards. Yeah.
Once a week, bar owner McElhone sorts and counts the ballots cast by passport-holding Americans and writes the tally on the mirror above the bar.
Wow.
It's a close one.
Wow.
Harris 63, Trump 58.
Now, this is why I'm stressed. Do you see how close it is right now?
Business consultant and Kamala Harris supporter Michael Foster can't believe it either.
Thought that being pulled in France, it would not be as close as it is. It's scary.
Tourist Mitchell Talisman is furious, not about politics, but because he just wanted to enjoy a cocktail.
I came to Paris to not have to think about the election. It's good to get away from all of that.
But this election year, that's easier said than done. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, at Harry's Bar in Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Come home to KAXE, your community radio station that keeps you connected to northern Minnesota. Whether it's local news, great music, or thoughtful conversations, KAXE is here because of listeners like you. Donate now at KAXE.org to keep your home on the dial strong and thriving. And tune into new music to hear the best of the new Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays at 2 and 10 p.m. and Sundays at noon. We receive support from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in a home setting. More information online at oakhillseniors.com. The next Loon Bird Cafe is Wednesday, October 23rd, now in a new location at Turtle River Chop House. The Lundberg Cafe occurs seasonally and features four local songwriters. Make your reservation by calling the Turtle River Chop House. We receive support from the Lake Superior Steelhead Association with a mission to protect and improve the cold water fishery of the Lake Superior region, bringing anglers together for the common good. More information available at steelheaders.org. All ages are invited to participate in Happy Dancing Turtles Fall Bingo Scavenger Hunt. Look for 24 items total, including a special feature on birds. Take photos of what you find and submit by November 1st. Register and find more details at happydancingturtle.org. There is a Take Back the Night event Thursday, October 24th at Central Lakes College in Brainerd with a panel discussion on partner violence at 6 p.m., followed by a luminary design, campus walk, and bonfire at 7. New Salem Lutheran Church in Turtle River has a trunk or treat event Saturday, October 26th from 2 to 4 with horse-drawn wagon rides, pizza, and other surprises.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. If Vice President Harris is going to win in November, she needs high turnout from Black voters in key states. Yesterday, she was in the Atlanta area and attended services at two Black churches as part of a time-honored tradition known as Souls to the Polls. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith has this postcard.
Get on your feet.
At New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Stonecrest, Georgia, Pastor Jamal Bryant and thousands of worshipers gave Vice President Harris a rock star welcome.
Would you scream for Vice President Kamala Harris?
Politics and religion have long been entwined at Black churches. And for Democratic politicians, going to swing state churches on Sundays in October is a must.
Good morning, church. Good morning, New Birth. Good morning.
Harris held back on her increasingly sharp criticism of former President Trump, not even saying his name.
Question: what kind of country do we want to live in? A country of chaos, fear, and hate, or a country of freedom, compassion, and justice? And the great thing about living in a democracy is that we, the people, have the power to answer that question.
Pastor Bryant didn't hold back.
If God has anointed us to flip the state once, we can do it again. Because if God be for us, who can be against us? This is an idea that cannot be stopped.
Georgia was thought to be a solidly red state until it went for President Biden 4 years ago. Harris's hopes for a repeat at least partially rest with the people filling these pews. Jonesboro, Georgia was Harris's second stop. At Divine Faith Ministries International, there was a very special guest.
Oh, Mother, yes, they rabbi took us to the merchant ship.
None other than Stevie Wonder serenaded worshipers, adding his own lyrics to Bob Marley's redemption song.
We need a landslide to unite the world and this nation. So I want all of you to handle your business. I love you. God bless you.
And by handle your business, he meant get out and vote. In her pitch at the Jonesboro Church, Harris took aim at apathy.
We have to remind people the power they have in spite of those that would try to diminish and make people feel powerless. In spite of those who would try and suggest that, oh, if you vote, nothing will happen, for sure.
As Harris finished, Wonder stood up and belted out a bar from his hit Higher Ground.
Keep on voting!
Harris suggested a new lyric as the whole room broke into song.
I'm not going to sing it, dear.
Tamara Keith, NPR News, Jonesboro, Georgia.
Students returning to college this fall are busy with the usual activities, getting to know their professors, studying in the library, but some are lining up for a different experience. At the University of Chicago, students can borrow an original work of art from the school's museum for free. From Chicago, Allison Cuddy reports.
The small courtyard outside the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago is normally an oasis of stately trees and stunning sculptures. On this warm fall Saturday morning, it looks and sounds more like a slumber party. Clusters of students are spread out along a concrete wall, wrapped in blankets, chatting and working on their laptops. Cups of coffee and bags of food are scattered around. Rafaela Grieco Freeman was the very first to arrive. She and the other students spent the night outdoors not as part of orientation, but for a work of art, museum-quality art, lithographs by Miró and Chagall, prints by Gordon Parks and Jenny Holzer, even a couple of Picassos.
I was like, no way this is real. Like, this is just, somebody's making something up. I'm getting fake news. And it's astonishing to be a part of this and be able to have these like priceless, you know, works of art and also like pieces of history just in a dorm room.
This annual event is not only real, it's been around since 1958, the brainchild of an alum, Joseph R. Shapiro, an avid collector and co-founder of Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art. Shapiro thought students would appreciate art if they could live with it. So he gave the university 50 works to start a lending program. The idea was a big hit from the start, and the collection grew. But in the late 1980s, it went dormant. Thanks to a new funder, it was rebooted in 2017 as Art to Live With, now run by the Smart Museum. Vanya Malloy, the Smart's director, thinks it offers students a new view on art and life.
Could be something you look at as you drink your morning coffee every day, and you see it in a different way, and maybe you notice things that you didn't before. So living with a work allows you to have this depth of experience that you wouldn't if you're just scrolling on your phone.
Any student living in campus housing can participate. Lauren Payne, who runs Art to Live With, says they do have to sign a loan agreement to keep the art for the school year.
Accidents definitely happen. You know, sometimes it might fall off the student's wall and the frame might get damaged or a hinge might get slipped. But, you know, there's never any malicious damage or anything that has been taken.
By late afternoon, the sun is beating down. Some students pass the time playing cornhole. Then the first check-in starts.
We're starting right over there.
Economics students Anwar Kul Mohammed and Rudra Patel have been waiting near the head of the line for more than 12 hours. They think they've got a good shot at their picks when the museum opens in the morning. Then Patel learns they'll go in as a group of 15.
Oh my God, bro.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I thought it was a group of like, what?
All right, group one. Everybody's here.
The next morning, they do get what they'd hoped for, an etching by one of the old masters, Francisco de Goya, and a woodblock by Japanese artist Ando Hiroshige, known for his epic landscapes. Even so, Anwar says he's not sure it was worth it.
Sleeping outside, you know, in the cold, it was just terrible. It was the worst night I've had here by far.
However, Isha Mehta did return for a second year. The economics and human rights student dressed to match her choice, a lithograph by pop artist Mel Ramos. She says the program has changed her.
And it did make me more interested in learning more about like the art and going to the Smart Museum exhibits. And it did encourage me to take a specific like art history class last year.
The future of Art to Live With might be up in the air. Its funding will run out after one more year. But for now, students head home, happily clutching an original artwork to hang in their dorm. For NPR News, I'm Allison Cuddy in Chicago.
It is just about 2 weeks until Election Day, and election season is already in full swing with mail-in and early voting well underway. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with the head of the decision team at the Associated Press about how the AP makes its calls about the presidential race and how long it might take to declare a winner. More tomorrow on All Things Considered. And you are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams, Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters on Friday, November 1st. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bangley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Check out playlist podcasts and more at KAXE.org. The Hibbing Area Chamber of Commerce, the City of Hibbing, and the Hibbing Foundation are teaming up for a Trunk or Treat event Saturday, October 26th from noon to 2 at Hibbing City Hall. One free pumpkin per child while supplies last. And Northland Arboretum in Brainerd has a Trunk or Treat Saturday, October 26th from 4 to 6. Their low scare trail will be open as well. Advance tickets available at northlandarb.org. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy. Slight chance for showers in the northwest Minnesota. Lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow, chance of showers and thunderstorms.